And ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
Well, that might be a normal introduction for our Hagman and Hagman Report, but it's certainly not a normal show. This is our on-air safety and security seminar. Folks, this is brought to you courtesy of a man who we have a lot of respect for, our lead instructor, joining both Joe and I here on the podium in front of you, virtual podium. Is Yoda. That's the pen name of our seasoned veteran counterterrorism team leader. He's a seasoned investigator. He's been in the intelligence world for the last half a century. That's hard to believe, but seriously, that's true. He's got decades of experience in consulting and training U.S. and allied intelligence, law enforcement, military, field operations, and SWAT teams. Yoda is still active in the field of counter-narco-terrorist cartel operations, so he maintains this pen name of Yoda. And I just would urge everyone, that as we approach class time here, to grab a notebook, grab a pen, and in my case, grab a drink of water, and get ready for some. Just an incredible amount of information that will help you keep safe in these times and the times ahead. Let me first bring on Joe. Joe, welcome to our course, online course of safety
here.
Security. Yes.
It's glad to be here. Ready to carry on from where we left off last week and get into some new items of preparation and security and what we need to do in order to be prepared for what we might face here in the near future. And hopefully it's something we don't face, but in case we do, we have to cover all aspects and bases of
we do.
Preparation.
You know, I didn't mean to overtalk you, but I failed to provide the website for our lead instructor, our course instructor, he is the founder and director of the magnifiedview.com, magnifiedview.com. That's hard linked off of our home base. That's homelandsecurityus.com. Magnifiedview.com. You've got to visit that website, bookmark the website, check it often, check it daily, as a matter of fact. It's got just a load of information on there. But without any further ado, let's bring on our lead instructor for our course, Yoda. Welcome.
Live from high atop the Magnified View in San Diego. Good evening, Detective Duggs and Joe. How are you guys?
Very well. Very well and ready to learn. We've got, we've had, for the folks tuning in, by the way, this has been a weekly course. And hopefully you've had the opportunity to listen to last week. We will be making these available for future distribution, but we're taking these in segments. Yoda, what are we looking for this week, or what are we going to be talking about this week on our show?
If you will, sir, we're going to review what we've done in the prior two segments. We're going to go ahead. Our objective tonight is auto security. And as time breaks, we'll see how it goes. We'll get into home security, if you will.
Very good.
Formats apparently worked the last two segments with you detectives participating. We have, at the Magnified View, have been deluged with telephone calls and with emails complimenting and asking questions about their personal safety and security, including far and wide from numerous states, from Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. So it seems to go well, gentlemen.
Yoda, you know, let me just say this, and for the new listeners, now I know our regular listeners know that in my lifetime, my uncle was viciously stabbed to death in a heinous murder that went unsolved for 5 years until our agency got involved and assisted the police in apprehending the individual responsible. That was my uncle, who was stabbed in my home, my parents' home, the home I grew up in. And it was a horrific murder. And I also had some very good friends who we vacationed with back in the 80s. A couple, his wife, her first name is Sally. She was kidnapped and murdered back in 1988. So, folks, if you don't think that this is important, if you don't think that this can happen to you, it can, because it happened to us, and we've had other issues subsequent to that as well. So with that, let me turn the course back to you, Yoda.
Thank you. The format, audience around the world, please imagine that you're either in an audience or a classroom. The seminar started with our teaching first responders, coppers, firefighters, EMTs, paramedics, as Doug once was, and their family. When emergencies occur, off goes the first responder, leaving the family at home to care for themselves. So that was the etiology or the beginning of this. It's since grown enormously. We've delivered it, I have as well, in churches, civic groups, all kinds of civilians. My style, if you will, is highly participative. So I like to look at the audience, see if anybody's gone to sleep or doing their nails. And I like a lot of interaction. So detectives Doug and Joe are helping me as instructors and in role-playing as audience for whatever I might miss or overdo. Doug and Joe, for the worldwide audience, have an extensive background in sophisticated investigations where they've interacted with the FBI and with other major letter agencies. So I not only view them as instructors, but they've got the street experience, which we hold in a lot of respect. We're not very academic or hypothetical. We like to give you folks actionable tactics and strategies that will help you both prepare and act on a threat when it occurs in front of you. So the format, if you will, is an audience or classroom. Let me break out in the first two segments and in the Hagman & Hagman report and on our website. We have undertaken a huge investigation of the downing of the helicopter in Afghanistan that killed 22 SEAL team operators. There's a lot of suspicious circumstance surrounding that downing. Many of those operators were also, not coincidentally, in the bin Laden raid that killed bin Laden. So that investigation, for our regular listeners to the Hagman Report and new people in the seminar, that investigation goes far beyond our wildest aspirations. We're getting a lot of positive response, whistleblowers at high echelon levels. So that's that. Here we go. Detective Doug and Joe, I've been answering a lot of emails, questions, comments, observations from listeners, really good ones. I answer them via email. I just got one, as you know, from a gentleman in the Chicago area. I'll identify only as MK or Mike Kilo. He sent an email. I'm going to jog out. It's appropriate to our curriculum tonight. quoting, a question I have for Yoda is, what if a vehicle or group of vehicles wants to cause you to be in an accident on purpose with them because they want you or your insurance company to pay the damages, or they may want to steal your vehicle and or your valuables? What should I do? Well, MK,
this happens a lot. Sorry to jump in, but this working in insurance investigations, a lot of people, you'd be surprised, they set up these rings where, you know, they stage these car accidents for different reasons. Mostly from our area, we've seen it be for insurance reasons, but as you said, it could be to steal your vehicle. They can make you vulnerable by having you stop your car, getting out of your car under a false pretense of you think you got into a fender bender, and they want to exchange information, and boom, before you know it, your whole world could be turned upside down.
Thank you, Detective Joe. That's a popular blood sport here in Southern California on the freeways. My best one of those, a Yoda anecdote, for the audience, that's an anecdote, only I'm saying it. There were illegals that would rent a car or steal a car or any kind of car, and they would literally, at 70 mile an hour plus, cut off a semi so the semi truck and trailer would hit them. That they did that deliberately, and that often didn't work out well, as you might imagine. So to MK's question, night and day always means a lot. The day season or night season, it's statistically likely to happen at night. If you're struck a little bit from the rear, pull over and then put on your hazard lights. Actually, University of at Evanston, Northwestern has shown that often turning on your left turn signal parked on a freeway is more effective than your hazard lights, which often tend to magnetically attract vehicles to run into you where the left turn signal doesn't. Anyway, onward, then travel at a slow pace. Obviously, you're not trying to flee. You didn't cause a rear-ended accident. Go to a police station or somewhere where there's a lot of people around. So that's a good way to deal with that. And I've lost my note here. That isn't good. But let me get my note back from MK. So if you're struck from behind, as Joe said, in a fender bender, if you will, just pull over, indicate that you're going to find help. If you've got a cell phone, of course, in Southern California here, 911 will get you the highway patrol. Tell them what you're doing, what you're involved with. If a unit's available, they will send one to the scene. Stay in your car with the left turn signal on and wait for the highway patrol. I work with the highway patrol. They're so undermanned, it may be a while till you get one. In that case, drive off at a slow pace, ideally to a police station or a place where there's a lot of people. And I've lost the thing here, but I'm getting it back. Bear with me, MK. And
I have a question for you, Yoda.
Sorry.
I have a question for you. Recently, I've seen in the news and on different places about undercover cops pulling over people on the highway in cars that are not issued by the police. And a lot of times people think they're being fooled, and sometimes you do have people that buy the lights and police lights and try to pull people over pretending to be the police. If you're in a situation where there's a car that has lights trying to pull you over, it doesn't look like a cop car, you're not sure, what's the best method to make sure
Excellent.
You're going to be okay there?
Question, Detective Joe. Some of that goes on out here, but not much. presume that they are not legitimate officers, because all legitimate officers do what's called a wall stop. By that, they follow you until they get a marked uniform unit to pull you over. That constitutes a wall stop. Only in extreme emergencies, life-threatening, will a genuine highway patrol, county, or city officer pull you over in an unmarked car. Federal agencies have drop-down red and blue lights on the right visor that slaps down, but they're certainly not going to pull you over without a marked unit anyway. So the odds of it being genuine is really slim. What I would do, if somehow I had holler out the window or something dialogue, I would immediately call their dispatch and ask them to identify the officer or come to the bona fide of the officer. Is that making sense, gentlemen?
Yeah, and so before you really pull over for this person, if it's questionable, you call the police to find out.
Exactly. They'll identify it in a heartbeat, which it won't be. I can't imagine a situation where an unmarked unit is going to pull you over. Well, of course, there's exceptions to anything. In a bad neighborhood at 1 in the morning on Saturday with shots fired, then the plainclothes guys would, but I think few in our audience is going to run into that.
Actually, Yoda, let me just say this. In New York State as well, in the Northeast primarily, we've seen where undercover police officers will do that in unmarked cars. And, in fact,
this happened to a family member.
Yes,
recently.
Yes. Yeah, as a matter of fact. In fact, I was on the interstate, which, you know, of course, on the West Coast freeways, and it was a traffic stop, but again, it was, if you would look at the vehicle, you would be hard pressed to really believe that it was a police vehicle. Now, ultimately, police vehicles showed up within several minutes. But, you know, again, you look at it and you think, well, this might not be true. So perhaps it's a geographical issue more than anything else. But, I agree with you. I would tend to err on the side of caution. Make sure if you've got a cell phone, and hopefully everyone does, and it's within range, get a hold of the local or the police, tell them exactly what's going on and that you're not fleeing an accident or whatever. You're attempting to verify the validity of the stop or of the person that's making the stop.
I thank you. Yeah. You certainly can't tell unmarked vehicles today. You can tell some with a couple spotlights and they're driving Crown Vicks. But here at Miramar Air Station, it's a Navy air station where Top Gun trains, there are literally thousands of confiscated cars, usually involved in drug deals. So plainclothes or undercover people today can drive anything, absolutely, pickups or SUVs or, you know, whatever. Cadillacs are all rundown things. They also have a huge area full of boats and airplanes. So, yeah, to your point, Detective Doug, they can be driving anything today, and they do. So the old days of Crown Vic are long past and over.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead, Doug.
No, it's, yeah, the old... the old ways of the marked vehicles. It seems like we're seeing more, and at least again, geographically speaking, Northeast, and even pockets within the Southeast, we're seeing more and more unmarked vehicles, uncharacteristic in appearance, that do have the removable emergency lights that do make traffic stops.
At least the tanks, the new tanks they use are marked.
Yeah, but try to outrun a try to make a traffic stop in that.
I could figure out if it was a tank.
Yeah.
Vehicles today, as you fellas know, the permanent vehicles have embedded lights in front and back. They have embedded red and blue. You can't see them unless they're lit up. So that would probably be a genuine police car. But I work all over the country. Well, I haven't for a little while, but I've heard the expression wall stop all over. It's in common usage in police department. And everybody wants to get a marked unit to make the stop for them. Federal agencies do that routinely. They call for a marked city or county unit. Anyway. Back to MK, if you will, my dear man in Chicago. I lived there for a while, or I operated out of there. With the marathon, he asks, Chicago Marathon is tomorrow. I am trying to read this. Concerned about another false flag attack. 45,000 runners, 1 million spectators, and that's a wow. A false flag for our new and international viewers. We have about 40% international viewers. That's a lot. A false flag is when government or someone else stages an event to get publicity or to draw attention away from themselves or blame somebody for the event falsely. So that's what MK means about that. That's a lot of people, MK. You need, and I bet you have situational awareness, you need to keep your eyes moving around and your head moving around and look for things out of pattern in crowds. Look for movement where people are static or stationary. Look for someone stationary where there should be movement. Detectives Doug and Joe have extensive surveillance and counter-surveillance experience. So if I miss something here, I'm always asking for their help. Look around you, MK. You'll see more pretty girls. And watch for odd, suspicious, furtive behavior. People that are not interested in the event, but interested in other people, excuse me, are either good guys or bad guys. So bad guys are always looking around for victims as opposed to the event they're attending, runners in this case. Good guys, the coppers, are always looking for bad guys. So look for furtive, suspicious, shady behavior. Look for what they're carrying and what's in their hands. Do not have anything set down, any large object, a suitcase or whatever, that would hold an explosive. Of course, you'd leave if one sat down and abandoned next to you. My best Yodik dealt with that. I was in Nigeria and holding a meeting in the Sheraton Hotel. It was a meeting with Nigerian officials. And I held it in the middle of the ballroom, which was empty at a table. Up comes a guy and he sets down a thing of flowers next to it. It turns out it was nothing, but we were certain it was a bomb delivery. There we are at a table with coffee and a thing full of flowers. So, MK, please look for anything set down next to you or in the area that shouldn't be. If you see such an object, there'll be a lot of coppers at the marathon, both uniformed and plain clothes. I would approach one of them and tell them about the object. All that could be, if it's an innocent thing, is a slight embarrassment. Wouldn't be embarrassing to me. Or if it's the real thing, you could sure save a bunch of lives.
Yeah, if I can just interject something here. What I would expect to see at this marathon is what was kind of what we saw at Boston. You're going to have, and because of the number of people there, you're going to have every agency, Alphabet agency, and every subcontracting agency present and carrying backpacks. So, you know, it's going to be, and generally speaking, they're going to be at the congregated either at the finish line or at the starting line. Now, there will be some with it at the various stations at the marathon throughout the course. But I would pay very close attention. And if you're present, I would take photographs, a lot of photographs of the crowd, because you'll never know if something does happen. Take them preemptively, because you'll never know what value they might serve for later purposes.
Right on, Detective Doug. Also, MK, I'm addressing it in this or another segment. Your automobile is a wonderful 2,000-pound weapon. It's only a 2,000-pound weapon if it's moving. So I imagine we all saw in the United States the motorcycle incident where motorcyclists terrorized a bunch of them, a guy in his car with wife and child, I think. They stopped
yes.
in front. It turned out really bad, but driving your car, you have a 2,000-pound weapon. You can take out other cars that are bothering you. You can eliminate motorcycles right and left. I heard on the news that you're defenseless in a car against moving motorcycles, which is absurd. If you tap their rear wheel and then drive through it, or the so-called pit maneuver, if the middle front of your car strikes either side of the rear of their car, they are going to spin out. The thing you do then is drive through that and continue on. Don't stop or turn right or left or try to hit the thing again. As well, if you back into a hostile car with your car, you're highly likely to disable the car you backed into because of the radiator, whereas often you can drive away. So be thinking, please, of getting off. We're all trained automatically. We stop at stop signs, and we stop at red lights, and we stay between the white lines, and we don't cross over the yellow lines. Think of what your vehicle can do. It can certainly go up on curbs and over lawns and do all kinds of things that we're trained not to do, but if you're confronted with an emergency, it's a good time to do that.
Well, Yoda, I'm sorry, Yoda, if I can ask you, I think we all saw the video of that incident that you talked about on the Henry Hudson Parkway, and Joe and I have traveled the Henry Hudson Parkway in Manhattan. And in fact, that was, I think, up toward Harlem, or I can't remember exactly where that was, but it was north of the city, or the north part of the city. If you were in that situation, if you were driving that SUV, you had your wife and young child in that vehicle, and you were surrounded by hostiles, motorcycles, what would you have done? What did that driver do wrong in that situation?
Thank you, Doug. Gee, I would enjoy that. But I've taught emergency vehicle operation, and I kidnap driving for before it had names. We taught Department of State Security on abandoned runways. The key is to keep your vehicle moving and simply tap. You've determined now that it's a hostile, aggressive motorcycle gang that's trying to hit you. You can take them out right and left, just tapping their, ideally, their rear wheel. A slight tap on that's going to send them into next week. So the key is to eliminate them with prejudice. Just lay them all over the street and go on your merry way and go get a coffee is what you can do. You don't dare stop because at the risk of repetition, stop, you're now a victim and penned up in this. I'm sure you fellas, in your investigations, when you could, jumped out of that car rather than sit there and be shot in the car. So motion is the key. Keep it in motion and take the motorcycles out. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense. When the driver of that vehicle, and I watched as much of the video as I believe was released or open source, the driver exited the Henry Hudson Parkway and was jammed up into traffic, which limited his options at that point. And, I most certainly would have kept, I mean, if it were me, and of course it's easy to say this now, I would have kept on the multi-lane road and attempted to deal with, or at least if, would you have slowed down even like 35, 40 miles an hour, but just to keep moving if you knew, for example, that you were going to be running out of freeway or interstate?
I'm going to, if my life is threatened or saving another life, I'm going to go very aggressive with the car. And I have done that in this country and otherwise. So I'm going to be very aggressive with it as a weapon. We should always stop at a red light, whatever, behind other vehicles, so you can see the bottom of the tires of the vehicle in front of you. So there you go. You're approaching, car stopped at a light. So stop far enough back, please, that you can see the bottom of the tires of that vehicle. That will allow you enough room to maneuver. Many people, a lot of people, I dare say most people, stop about 3 inches from the vehicle in front of them, so they have no room to go forward. We actually trained in demolition derbies. We did 3 of them where you drive old cars around running into each other in a stadium to see who's the last guy left. You don't have much gas in them for a fire hazard and other stuff, and you carry a flag on them. And when you're disabled, you pull the flag off. So some organizations still practice in what are called demolition derbies. The key is motion. Keep that thing in motion. You can clearly win it against motorcycles. I've heard all week on television that you can't win with a motorcycle confrontation, which is preposterous. Of course you can't. You got this big thing, you know, there.
Right, right.
They're an early motorcycle.
Yeah. It's amazing, Yoda, what you hear on the television news versus what is reality. And I've got to say this, just so people know as well, in 1978, I did take, in fact, not one, but 2 emergency vehicle drivers training course and the I can't remember what they called it back then, but it's the equivalent of evasion and evacuation. Is that what they still call it now? I don't even know.
The ba- basic course is called EVOC. It's Emergency Vehicle Operators. It's 11 minutes with all the cones in the world.
And then there's another one. Yeah, that one, yeah. But then there's the other one that's the more aggressive, the more aggressive course. But well, nonetheless, the principles haven't changed over the years, have they? I mean, really?
Not at all. No.
Okay. All right. Okay.
It's gotten more sophisticated with armored cars. So that adds an element, you know. They're harder to drive. They're heavy. They're not nearly as agile. Also, anti-kidnap driving, it adds an element. You're armed with live fire to and from the cars. But the secret with anti-kidnap and all of this is to keep that thing moving.
Okay.
The public gets some sense of security sitting in a car, and it's the worst thing in the world they could do. In some circumstances, and you folks have an intelligent audience, you want to pop out of there so you're not like a sardine victim. A minor Yodikdo teaching Department of State once on an abandoned runway near Washington, D.C., with rental cars. We inadvertently left a smoke grenade in a glove compartment, so that it didn't go off. But the car rental agency sure wanted to know what that was. We had a little explaining to do. That was fun.
Did it go off while you were inside the car?
No, it was just in the glove compartment.
Rental
agency found it, you know.
Okay.
There are a couple courses for civilians, and there are several bad courses. They're sponsored by race drivers, so they really don't know this business that we're talking about. They know about going around in a circle. So a few of them have started up defensive driving for civilians, for citizens. And the citizens probably already know what they need to know about going around in a circle. So if you're going to take a defensive course, make sure you vet, make sure you check on the validity. If you like, drop Doug or Joe and I an email, and we'll tell you the good ones from the bad ones. Back to old MK in Chicago. He commented that sometimes I scare them. I'm not in the ghost business, MK. The more you learn, and thank you indeed for a wonderful email inquiry. MK sent it to Doug and Joe and Steve Quayle and I. It was a great inquiry that I wanted to share with the entire audience. The more you learn, the more confident you'll be, MK, and the safer you'll be. So really, the less scared you'll be at the marathon or in your car or anywhere. Quick Yoda anecdote, MK, in Schiller Park, that's a suburb of Chicago, near O'Hare, I had rented an apartment where in 1 year I spent all of 30 nights. So I left it there open to the press. I left the apartment and a car. And I never came back. There wasn't green stuff growing, biological experiments in the fridge. It was great. The apartment was clean. The car was clean and full of gas. So home I come one night in a blizzard for Chicago people's or the area's view. I had to walk down Irving Park Road to River Road. So I got to my apartment. And a lot of loud music, a gal opens the door, and she says, "I'm sorry, but it's just full of press and Secret Service tonight. There's no room on the floor even." And a friend of mine in the background said, "That's Yoda. He owns the apartment." So they made room for me anyway. So thanks sincerely, MK. Great email. What are we doing now, Detective Doug and Joe?
Well,
what am I?
Well, let me make sure that we've covered vehicle safety and security. And once again, I think you made a great point. Most people feel like they're in they've got the illusion of security in their vehicle. And I think they're perhaps really most vulnerable in their vehicle, especially when they're exiting their car, let's say the gas pump. You know, if you don't have a weapon on you, a concealed carry, for example, of a handgun, what weapons, let's talk about what you should carry in your vehicle to make it safer, especially for ladies.
Okay. Back to our weapons. I have no use for tasers. They have a place in law enforcement, but I have no use for them for civilians because electrocuting yourself is not a cool idea. That leaves firearms. There's two kind of people. Bill Jordan, the legendary Border Patrol inspector who invented a lot of stuff, at the national matches at Camp Perry teaching said, some old boys and girls cotton to guns and other ones don't cotton to guns. Jordan was head of their unit in El Paso. So I found that to be true. If you cotton to guns, then be trained in it and learn tactics, how to behave with it and what you do and move around and stuff is as important as the marksmanship part. So I am pro everybody being armed to defend themselves. It's a matter of statistical fact where people are armed with concealed carry permits, crimes to person goes down. Where they're not permitted carrying concealed weapons, Chicago, New York, Mexico at large, crime goes off the screen because only the bad guys have guns. It just makes sense. Throughout history, all governments that have confiscated weapons, their motive has really been total control of the population. There is no other reason in the world to confiscate people's firearms. I can't imagine even these gun-free zones. That's certainly an invitation for the bad guy who'll presume he's the only one that'll have a gun there. So I believe people that want to be and think they should be armed, be trained with a handgun. After that, there are impact weapons. That's anything that's like a club or a baton. We used to call them clubs, nightsticks. They're not batons. That's what band leaders have. Anyway, flashlights, tire irons, other things act as excellent impact weapons. Hitting people in the head often doesn't work at all. But hitting them where bone is near the skin, in the ulnar or radial bone in the arm or shin, does a good job and disables them. Which brings us to edge weapons, knives that you cut people with. This is a grim subject, I'm well aware, audience, and I certainly wouldn't offend anybody's sensibilities, but we are talking about saving our life or somebody else's flat out. That's what it is. Two kind of edge weapons, one you poke with and one you slash with, are discouraging to the bad guys. Finally, into pepper spray. With the right percentage of the active ingredient is an excellent weapon, defensive weapon, for what it is made for. That's to get you out of harm's way using the pepper spray. Detective Joe, how am I doing, brother?
Fantastic.
Okay. What am I supposed to be doing? Well, I can't see the audience, but I can see you.
One more question about this, about pepper spray, because I know a lot, personally, I know a lot of women that walk around with this. You're traveling in a car, and you know you've got wisdom involves anticipation and sort of survival. Where is a good place to keep? You know, all the women I know keep their pepper spray at the bottom of their purse. So if something happens and you're driving, or you're getting gas or whatever. But let's say you're driving and something happens. Where's the best place to keep, let's say, your pepper spray or that tire iron or some impact weapon that you, if you don't have a gun, front seat, dashboard, visor?
I keep two of them, Doug, in the car and one in my person. Two in the car, one I presume I'm driving. One is in the left door, there's a place to hold stuff. The other is in the center thing that holds stuff. So I keep two of them there. It, as you said, thank you, they're no good if you have to fish around for them. Also on foot, having them in your hand is a wonderful idea. It's something you don't have to do later if you're confronted with a threat. If you have it in your hand by your leg, I promise you, other than cops, nobody's going to see it. I've walked around, Lord knows where, with a gun in my right hand by my right pants leg, and very few people see the gun. So I'd rather have it out so I don't have to do it later. So the key, it doesn't hurt to have it walking out of a mall in your hand, particularly at nighttime, you know, on the way to the car.
Right.
In the car, it's got to be readily available, or it's no good.
Or in some place that's relatively, it's not going to be jostled out of its position, and you're going to be, you know, on the passenger side leaning over trying to find it. So we've got to make sure that doesn't happen. Okay, good. Now, car safety, still talking about this. At what point are you most vulnerable? And I suspect this is probably a very academic question. That would be what, entering and leaving your car?
Yeah, first you're most vulnerable. They've got to pick you up somewhere. From your point of departure and your point of arrival, as you fellas, I'm sure, did in surveillance and counter-surveillance. So you're vulnerable getting out of the car, more so getting back into it. Please look around. Should you see, particularly ladies, should you see a van next to your car that wasn't there when you pulled in anywhere, I would simply not get in your car until you were escorted. Not incidentally, cities today are fudging their crime stats. I've covered that in an earlier segment. Galloping through it quickly. Their city fathers or mothers are very clever about this. Before they're voted in, they complain about crime, and the day after they're voted in, they claim they've cured crime. So the liberal press loves to pick this up, supporting their liberal politicians, minimizing the hell out of crime. Excuse me. It's incredibly minimized. Basically, they set ordinances and other rules where felonies are reduced to misdemeanors. In turn, they're reduced to incidents. In turn, they're reduced to advisements. Those statistics are then supplied to the FBI. They're published far and wide as crime statistics, and people become complacent, particularly in medium and large-sized cities, and believe there's no crime, whereas it's risen lately exponentially. In addition, they're laying off coppers and firefighters and EMTs right and left. some departments are laying off half of their people. Coppers are also confronted today with mountains of paperwork, so you have boots on the desk as opposed to boots on the street. So please don't believe the statistics you're reading about your city, because I will bet you they're way minimized.
All right. Yeah, in fact, they are. All right, to switch gears just a little bit here, we're all expecting. I mean, I think the majority of us that see what's taking place here in this country, we're expecting the potential for, well, I don't want to say necessarily full-blown martial law, although that's a possibility, but perhaps travel restrictions during an emergency. Let's say you're an hour away from your house, 2 hours, 40 minutes, I don't care. You're a distance from your house. You want to get home. Where are the police most likely to, I mean, if your intent was to get home during the course of an emergency in progress, regardless of whatever emergency that was, where you know that you're going to run into travel restrictions, any advice there?
Yes, sir, and thank you for an excellent question. Let me plug the magnified view once. We have a section of pretty extensive of Yoda's predictions. And we actually, they're not Yoda's. We get them from a crack team around the world, and then we assemble them and evaluate them and then disseminate them over my name. We have been uncannily accurate so far with specific predictions. So, betting on a roll, I am predicting civil disturbances, and I dare say before the first of the year. A part of my rationale is that the damnable Obamacare now is causing nearly everybody to go to under 30-hour work weeks. Fast-forwarding, that reduces millions of people's income by 25%, while they're going to pay a lot more premiums for the nonsense insurance. So they're making 25% less, while taxes are rising, while then they're going to get a deductible. So they're hit both sides. As today in Greece, Ireland, Spain, elsewhere, Argentina now, Brazil, we don't get news on our American news stations, as you're aware. It's just the flavor of the day. All of those countries are in continuous riots. I don't know how they, like Greece, can continue it indefinitely. They do. Unemployment is all-time high. They also flood the unemployment statistics, add underemployment, and it's at or a little bit over Great Depression levels because they screw around with those statistics. When people drop off when they quit getting unemployment checks, they're then not counted as unemployed anymore, for example. So with a hard analysis and evaluation, I believe we are coming to civil disturbances. I believe further that our current president, Obama Hussein, whatever, is hard over taking utter control of the population every way he can. I'm concerned lately that he's doing it boldly. He doesn't seem to care. Who knows it?
Exactly.
So I'm daring to predict some event before the first of the year. Christmas coming, but he's going to have any money. So we will certainly address preparation. But, boy, I've taken a while to answer your question. This emergencies occur in your perception like instantly. They're not like a movie where you see it in slow motion and it takes time to occur. 1 minute you're thinking about work or being out of work or whatever you're doing. And the next instant, you get it on the radio, there's a traffic jam. Your interstates or freeways will jam up impassable in a matter of minutes. So always look, as you said in our last segment, Detective Duck, have a real map with you because GPS is iffy in these times. And plan a route, know where you're going, not on the freeway or interstate, and go directly home. Don't screw around and find three errands to do, wishing you had prepared, but that's the time to go home. It's difficult to describe how quickly it seizes up. It just goes up. Sir.
Okay. Perfect. Now, so obviously, take the road less traveled once an emergency is declared, or that you're in a involved in a situation where there's potential problems, travel problems, travel restrictions. Take the road less traveled. Now, while we're talking about vehicles. You know, I got a question, and in fact, I just got this via email. Someone is looking to purchase a replacement vehicle. Their vehicle is worn out, asking you, tactically, is there a better vehicle over another? In other words, when they're replacing their vehicle and they're thinking about, you know, anything that could happen, what kind of vehicle? Would it be a 4x4 SUV-type vehicle would be the best? Would it be a pickup truck? Would it be a four-wheel drive? Would it be a Hummer? I mean, obviously, we're, you know, within common sense means here.
Yeah. Big is good. I'll bet you fellows in the audience have been in or covered a lot of accidents, so big is the kind of thing to drive around in. These little mousetraps are just unhealthy in any kind of accident. So look at a police station, fire station lot. When you drive by them, you'll see a lot of firefighters and coppers in pickups. That's not an accident. They do that concerned about a traffic collision. You can also maneuver that and bump your way around if you have to. Certainly a pickup with an overhead sleeper would be a good idea if it really goes down for a sustained period. A lot of it has to do, of course, with budget, but I favor big ones over little ones. I've taught driving for years, and I'm not really a car guy. I'm ridiculed all the time about, I have to look at who made the thing. It has to be written somewhere.
I get that.
I get on police radio and I say, well, it looks like a jelly bean and it's red. I don't know what it is. So.
Well, now, this is a question from a listener. In fact, I think we might have touched on this before. But, you know, if you are driving or if an emergency has already erupted and there is rioting in the streets and, you know, think Rodney King on a national level, the Rodney
yeah.
King riot, to bulletproof your car to a little extent or to protect you, is it true, this MP writes, is it true that phone books in the doors or the equivalent thereof would protect you from certain small arms fire? How's that for a question?
Yeah. Thanks for the excellent question. We call it hillbilly armor. Most people use steel. Rather small gauge steel. As you fellas know, it's all about what you put up and what caliber it defeats. You know, like a bullet-resistant vest. they're rated to defeat different calibers. The heavier they are, the basically the greater caliber they defeat. And if you stick a steel plate in them, they defeat even more powerful calibers. The big problem under fire in a car is, of course, windows. If you look, unlike the movies, if you look at cars shot up, it's often the windows, as often as the doors. So the only protection for windows is Lexan, and that's a GE bullet-resistant glass product. And one I can't pronounce the name out of now, out of Japan. It is incredibly thick to defeat any kind of caliber. It is hugely expensive. You then can't any longer open the windows. You're stuck with that. And if you're like me, you can't smoke in the car anymore. So as you fellows are expert in, Doug and Jeff, anything is better than nothing to have, so any armor would be better than no armor, sure.
Well, an extension of that... Okay, I'm sorry. An extension of that question, are there companies out there, to your knowledge, that will bulletproof your windows? Well, I shouldn't say bulletproof, but make them bullet-resistant, like the material that you're talking about. Put it on there, put it on the windows for you?
Thanks, Doug. It's a fad now as we speak in Hollywood. You go buy an SUV thing, anyway. You drive it to these places, and they fully armor it to your spec. So you can have it quite armored to defeat small rifle calibers. Or you can get the whole package. You're adding enormous weight to it. And its handling is totally different than it was. Mexico City, there's one on every corner. It's the kidnap there, and 20 million people. The kidnap rate's tremendous. So, quick anecdote, there was an outfit out of Texas. I was in Guatemala, in the capital city, and down they came to a big hotel, and they stuck three SUVs with different rate of armor in them and invited everybody to a cocktail party. Everybody came. And these vehicles were really impressive. The first one was armored, and the second one was really armored, and the third one dropped oil and stuff on the ground that would flatten the pursuing vehicle's tires, and if you touch the door handles, you get electrocuted, and it exuded CNRC, a tear gas. So anyway, they took orders you wouldn't believe. They were then driving them down to deliver them back to Guatemala. There we go. Three colonels one night, they bought one of these. Okay, I forget the cost. They're really expensive. Three colonels one night had theirs, privately owned. They were coming home. They're about half drunk. They rolled it off the road down a little ravine, and they didn't like the way it was, so they started shooting at it with .45. It wasn't armored at all. So they were delivering unarmored, armored cars.
Perfect.
I'll bet they weren't in Guatemala after that.
I guess not. But the answer to the question is certainly, if you wanted to, for example, if the average person wanted to armor their windows, there are retail or places that will put armor on the windows. Is it a coating, or is it, do you have to replace the entire window, the windshield?
No, it's a hunk of glass. Mm. It's a real thick hunk of glass.
Okay.
You'll see them in banks and elsewhere. They're surrounding tellers and like aquariums with it today.
I got you. All right.
In the day. Kevlar, as you fellas know, the bullet-resistant cloth stuff. It goes in bullet-resistant vests. It's expensive also. You could armor almost anything with Kevlar, but it's ineffective when it's wet. So you wouldn't put it in the car door. So that's that.
Mm.
It's really expensive.
Also, when it comes to the tint in the windows, there are laws. I know if things are crazy, you're not going to get pulled over by the police. But here in Pennsylvania, for instance, if your window tint is, you know, just a little dark, you can get pulled over because there are regulations. This is, I know, different from the armored glass you were talking about. But when darkening your windows, especially if it's going to be soon, you know, you're going to want to do this, then you're going to have to look state by state for the regulations to see how dark you're allowed to have your windows.
Exactly. Yeah. They're strictly enforced here.
Do you recommend, for safety reasons, though, tinted windows within state law, you know?
I recommend, Doug, being as inconspicuous as you can.
Okay.
So obviously, not flashing money in a department store or fancy clothes or exotic luggage tags. You know, try to blend in. And have your car, as you fellas did professionally, have your cars blend into the neighborhood is what I really recommend. Anything that looks sinister in real dark windows do, you know. A trick that I'll bet you fellas used, if you roll the driver's window down so it cuts your face in half, you probably won't be identified from another vehicle, personally, from another vehicle or on the street. So roll the window down about half, you know, so it cuts your face. The bottom half will reflect, and they won't ID you personally. Am I telling that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. Right on the money. All right, I've gotten two class questions here sent to me via email asking if we could get into home security now, if that is within the course syllabus. And the questions are pretty specific. Home security on a budget. What we have a single mother, two children, school-age children, ages 9 and 12, lives alone in a single-family home. Let's see here. I'm going through this. And it looks like she is concerned with being vulnerable to burglary, robbery, home invasion. Okay. And, of course, she wants to, of course, keep her children safe. She lives in a two-story. She does give a little bit more detail than that with an attached garage. Now, if you are going to do a security evaluation for this woman, sight unseen, recommendations for being secure in her home. And the second part to that question, which is actually another classmate, I'll call this person, asked as well, when things do get dicey and home invasions and home robberies, burglaries become more prolific, you know, what are the more severe steps to take? So we can take the first one, normal conditions today, and then gradually increase our security as the times change. So I'll let you field those questions.
Thank you, listeners, for the questions. I feel like I'm back where I belong in an audience or classroom. You want to elevate your home one level above the neighbors. You want to do that not obviously. If you put concertina barbed wire out and all kind of trick stuff, then you might attract the bad guys because they'll think there's things that are of value. So the principle is to elevate your home, make it somewhat more difficult than the neighbors. False signs of security are wonderful. So there's a lot of places you can get signs indicating you have a burglar alarm. That's a cheap burglary tool. When you leave the home, leaving your TV on is a poor man's good burglar repellent. There's a thing on the market, I'm sorry I don't know the name of it, and your best burglar alarm is a dog, a yappy dog. So those in the know will tell you that what I just said, that burglar alarms are really problematical. They go off all the time. Like car alarms, they're usually ignored. I've seen incidents with noisy siren things where burglars aren't even deterred by them. They are by dogs. There's a thing on the market that's noise sensitive. So somebody knocks on the door, and this automated thing sounds like a barking dog. It's wonderful. You could find that on the net somewhere. Motion lights are wonderful. Outdoor lights that sense motion. Quick Yoda ikdote, a missionary priest was a chaplain at UCLA. He was, in fact, the hostage held in Beirut. His name was Father Jenko, by Hezbollah terrorists. His priest house was broken into monthly. No kidding. So off we went. We went to some big box store and bought a bunch of outside lights, and that was the end of that. So I highly recommend outside motion-sensitive lights. Be careful with bars that you have a way out of there in the event of a fire. So I think if you need bars, if the neighborhood has bars, you should probably look at another neighborhood. So we're covering outside signs. Deadbolt locks are essential. Not little flimsy. Dinky.
Okay, Yoda, before we switch from bargain, and I don't mean to demean anyone, bargain basement security approach by false signs, are there, and this is going to sound really, this is my question now, are burglars, can they tell if it's a store-bought sign, in other words, a generic sign, where you're just making this up? Because I do know that they've got false, you know, for $39 you can buy a pretend video camera, for example, outside video camera. You know, are the more sophisticated among the bad guys immune to the false signs and false props?
Yes, some are, but typically not in middle-class neighborhoods. Most burglars today occur in the day season when you're at work. Kids are at school. And they're most often drug-related. So addicts will do anything to get drugs. They'll risk severe penalties for burglary of an inhabited dwelling in the day season. They just do that a lot. So they're not very sophisticated. That's probably the enemy you're defending against.
And if I could jump in here real quick on the home alarms, I have a recently installed in a security system, and they are nice. And you have to consider this, though. If the electricity goes out, your home security system is no longer any good. Also, you know, if we're looking at a major grid shutdown, it's just basically garbage. Whereas a dog is obviously something that will doesn't work when the power goes on and off. It will always be there for you. And the availability or ability to take the dog with you if you have to leave also, increases your security there. So a dog, I'd say, is the best security, home security identifier or mechanism to use, because not only can it tell you that somebody's there, it can also protect against an intrusion, and it is also something you can take with you when you leave, not like a built-in home security system. So.
They've gotten the under-strength departments have gotten rid of burglary and other squads. They've put them back in uniform and sent them out in a beat car. So the bad guys are aware there's no burglary unit anymore. That's not a good thing, or a highly reduced burglary unit. What was I going to say? There are a lot of soft cases now. By that I mean people under a pretense knocking at your door to see who responds and your vulnerability. Many travel under false sales ID. Some go so far as say they're representing the telephone company and other utilities. So as with not a wall stop by an unmarked car, it takes you a minute to call up the utility and ask if this guy's that guy. Also, looking out to see those guys, if they have a proper truck, is a good idea. But many, even addicts at lower level in lower and middle class homes, are doing soft cases. It happens a lot. You're vulnerable to workmen. Today, in middle or upper middle, the bad guys from cartels, and they're all over the country, the cartels, they follow maids and they follow gardeners and whoever else, and they roll them up and intimidate them and offer them money to advise them of your habits, when you're there, when you're not there, what you have in the house and where you have it in the house. So you need be extremely discreet in hiring anybody today. A lot of that's going on all over. My poor neighbor is an L.A. fire lieutenant, and the lovely guy, poor guy, had all kind of workmen in, Lord knows what they were doing. And our investigation revealed that a painter, I think, was grabbed by the bad guys. And they cleaned out the poor lieutenant's house anyway. It was gone. So be aware of the soft case. Be aware of opening the door to anybody that you don't know. A lot today are running around in pairs, two bad guys. They'll enter the home under some pretext. One will distract you while the other one is rifling your stuff in another room. A lot of that's going on. So I like the, as you fellas are expert in, it's whatever you put up against it, something can defeat it, you know. If they put enough against you, but we presume they won't in the average two-story garage-attached home. So a sign, please get the motion lights. They work like a charm. Install deadbolts in your door. That slows them down instead of flimsy locks. What else? The dog, for sure the dog, if you want a dog. Or get the thing that sounds like a dog. I get a big kick out of that thing.
Well, okay, good. Yeah, I do have a very... I like the dog approach. We have, of course, a 140-pound German Shepherd that acts as a burglar alarm and a deterrent for door-to-door salespeople as well as... Well, just about
pulling
anybody.
His owner into trees.
No, that's true. But, you know, he's got his moods. We do have a class question here from Larry concerning traveling, going back now, and I do know that we're kind of going off the course here a little bit, the syllabus, but traveling when there are travel restrictions, because, folks, Yoda has lived in countries where he's had to operate while that country has been under martial law. And this is what Larry is asking. Would you describe, and I'm going to read this verbatim, and then you can answer this and dissect this accordingly. Would you describe the best way to travel at dusk or night? If you are in a car, your lights would give you away. Now, this would be especially true to helicopters and now drones. How would you suggest one to travel by night, given those conditions of full-blown curfew, dusk to dawn curfews, but you just got to get where you need to go?
Tough game. Don't turn the lights off. The first thing the bad guys do is sneak around with their lights off. So that comes to your immediate attention as a cop. They're either drunk or they're bad guys. People steal cars and then drive around with the lights off. They think they're cool. So you'll come to much less scrutiny and attention leaving your lights on. Don't speed, because that is an immediate red flag. It's really difficult to move around any distance because of ambush roadblocks. So you come around a corner and you perceive a checkpoint or roadblock in full-on martial law. That's not a good time to turn around, because behind and in front of the roadblock, they have weapons, usually machine gun positions. And they're not into your turning around at the last minute. So it's really a dicey question. And I'm trying to think about it. In full-on martial law, curfew goes down. You've got National Guard who are 19 years old that work in the lawn and garden department of a store all week. Now with an M16. So they're scared to death. So it's really dicey to be out in the first place unless you really need to be. You could get a visor, red and blue light. Red, of course, is fire and blue is law enforcement. You could nerve it out with that and a visor and proceed at a sedate pace. That would go real uncomfortable if you were caught. My best advice is not being out after dark if there's a curfew. Really, it's really dangerous, you know. How am I doing, Doc?
Well, very good. I'm just trying to think this through. Looking at the expansiveness of our country, but then, you know, of course, the police can only be in so many places, but then you've got the National Guard, of course, that could be elsewhere. So, I mean, you could have a pretty fair saturation of roadblocks, of surveillance, and then, of course, you know, as the attendee asked about helicopters and other methods of surveillance, yeah. You know, so, you know, yeah, wow.
My personal concern is DHS, FEMA, and TSA, and a couple other alphabet soups will get together. They're doing that now. As everyone knows in the States, way outside their charter off the reservation that they can't even address as Department of Homeland Security has bought billions of military rounds. It's preposterous to even imagine what they might do with them. So my real concern is enforcement by an agglomeration of Homeland Security, TSA, and FEMA, and Lord knows. FEMA is in an enforcement, armed enforcement thing now. So I'm more worried about them than I am the National Guard kid. But it's really dangerous, you know. I was, I was in Belize. Used to be British Honduras. They held hold down there that they're now advertising on TV that it's real near home and property's cheap. Yeah, I guess it is. Anyway, you're guaranteed conjunctivitis or pink eye when you arrive. Anyway, I'm in a cab. The UN run the Brits out, who were tickled to death to leave. And I was in a cab approaching a national Belizean checkpoint entering the airport. I ride the front seat of cabs for obvious reasons. Dozen of Belizean conscript drafted about 17 come, sticks a rifle in inside my window. At which time the British sixth Harrier fighter plane they had crashed with a lot of noise. They'd crashed six out of six. This was the sixth one. And the 17-year-old put a round through the windshield by the driver. So flukes happen in emergencies as well as other times. So few people recognize that the regular stuff goes on even more so. More bad guys come out, more people have toothaches, other people have heart attacks, and all the routine, people have babies, all the routine call stuff goes on and is exacerbated, added to the new emergency. So I would recommend, unless you have to go A to B, I would stay home. I usually travel around with nationals of authority, you know, with local police or military or whatever they are, and it's scary if you're with them, much less on your own. So what else can I say about it, Joe? Joe's not there. Doug?
Yeah, I think I'm right here. I thought we had a little
sorry, I'm here.
There.
I was double muted. I had myself double muted. Excellent points. And talking about, you know, emergencies, what it happens during emergencies, and adding to that, you know, regular life, people emergencies. Something you talked about last weekend, you know, getting extra medications in case you do have a problem with your tooth, or you can imagine all the possibilities. The problems you can run into not having proper healthcare resources and there being no hospitals or doctors you're able to go see in these times. So, you know, first aid kits, learning how to do basic wound care, taking
exactly.
CPR classes. These are things that are going to be needed too. People are going to need to learn how to have these services and skills so that they can not only help themselves but their families and the people that are around them.
Thank you, Joe. I'm embarrassed. One of our listeners, I've learned most while instructing, I'll bet you guys have. One of our listeners sent me a wonderful add-on to the med question. And I look for it today. I don't have a good excuse, but I will find her email, at least for next week's thing. She added that many meds deteriorate over time. I told her that the U.S. Army ran a study that they, by name, you can find it on the internet, but a lot of them last virtually forever. Of course, those refrigerated, this nice lady pointed out, don't. I told her that the big enemy of meds or water is sunlight. So keep bottled water out of the sunlight. Darn it, she made some other really good points that I promise, nice lady out there, wherever you are, I will pick it up for next Saturday.
Yeah, Yoda, it's interesting because, let me just say this, the U.S. military did put out a list of medication, the generic, and I believe also that also included the brand name. However, they put it now, it's behind a password-restricted site.
Oh.
So I find that rather interesting. In fact, Holly Dale and I were talking about this. Holly Dale wrote the book Dare to Prepare, which, by the way, folks, it's an excellent reference manual for situations like this. But, yeah, so now – but you're right. I mean, do not throw medication out after the best use date by or expiration date necessarily. I would not do that. I would consider keeping it beyond the expiration date, but there are some exceptions to that, and of course we'll get into that at a later time. Now, okay, the Kelly from Idaho writes about home security, and I know we're jumping around here a little bit, but it's yeah, this is incredible. She has. And she feels that she's got a pretty good handle on security. She says, I have a whole house generator that is connected to her natural gas supply. In the state of emergency or the state of decline, if everything goes, you know, south, will natural gas still be able to be pumped? Or, in other words, will she have access to the natural gas? Or will that natural gas not, you know, not be available?
Solar is really the answer. The problem with generators, everything, is you run out of fuel, including natural gas. That would be the problem. While I think of it, I talked to your sponsor who sells, what's the name of it? It is
American Survival Wholesale.com.
Gentleman,
yes.
There, he's really first class. You guys are doing a good job together. What's his name? Chance?
Correct.
Yeah, I was really impressed with this guy. Nice guy. He likes working with you guys. He's doing a good job. There's all kind of rip-off prepper stuff today, you know, and he's not one of them, I'm happy to say. Back to one of your earlier questions from a viewer. The best home defense gun weapon, bar none, is a 12-gauge shotgun. They're available with a pistol grip as opposed to the stock, the things that sticks out the back of it. Why do you want a pistol grip? Because working around tight corners in a house, you can get hung up with a long shotgun with a stock and barrel, whereas with only a pistol grip on it, you can move around. With a common pellet load, a shot load, you're going to win whatever it is with a 12-gauge. You don't have to be good at it. There's a fear factor with all weapons, any and all weapons. Back to the caveman who was waving a dinosaur bone around it. You want fear if you're on the right side of the weapon. And the 12-gauge looks sinister, causes enormous fear. And when you yank on the trigger, whatever's out there goes away, you're going to win it. I think you got an email about a weapon, I think, Detective Doug, did you? I think.
Well, yes, and I'll have to say, or I'll say this, folks, my weapon, my home defense weapon of choice is a Mossberg Persuader 590. That's the model. It's a Mossberg Persuader 590. And that, it has a pistol grip, and it holds, I believe, 7 shells.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I was talking to Steve Quayle about the ammunition to buy. Now, of course, the traditional ammunition for this is the general pellet, but you can buy ball ammunition that'll take out a radiator. That'll just do a lot of damage if you find yourself in an oncoming or at the wrong end of an oncoming vehicle. So
I have the same weapon, Doug. I would advise you to store 6 rounds in it as opposed to 7 because it depresses the spring in the thing. Also, the 220-grain pumpkin ball, the big round thing you're talking about, I intersperse that with the shot load. So I've got one up shot and the next one up, and I teach that, is a pumpkin. We call them pumpkin ball. The big round thing, it's 220 grains of lead. I'm with you. And it works.
Okay. Well, yeah. I'll tell you, taking that out shooting will... certainly that will do the trick. Indeed, for a home defense weapon, and contrary to belief, too, the pistol grips and even the handling of that particular weapon for ladies, it's not that bad. I mean, it's not as bad as one might expect. Now, I wouldn't put it up against my cheek, obviously, but
thank you. Yeah, all police women qualify with a pistol, rifle, and shotgun, and other stuff. So, I love having women in a beginning class of marksman cops, because as we boys did, we didn't play cops and robbers and hold a toy gun wrong. As you fellas know, the hold on any weapon is important. Girls don't know this. So when you teach them, they hold it right immediately. They usually exceed the males right out of the box. So I get a big kick out of it. But they're all qualified in those 3 weapons and more. So I want to really underline bold what you said. It's not a feminine, ladies shoot quite as well as men do.
That's right. And if I can add something here, I know this is not our weapons area, but I ran into this situation personally with a woman that has arthritis really bad in her hands. You're not going to be buying a semi-auto pistol. My recommendation there, and Yoda, let me get your take on this, for self-defense purposes would be a revolver, very simply.
Yeah, yeah. I'm an all-wheel gun. For our foreign listeners, that's a revolver thing instead of the semi-automatic thing. Yeah, I'm an all-wheel gun guy.
Hey, Yoda, what would you say? I'm sorry. What would you say would be a good amount? Twice a month, once a week, to get to the shooting range to make sure that you're have your weapons. Under control, you know how to work them, you're staying updated, cleaning them, et cetera, making sure that they're always ready. And what's a good amount of time period, how many times a month would you say you should visit the range to make sure you're up on your shooting?
Depending on your level, once a month will certainly do it, depending on your level of accomplishment with it. I fired the Nationals at Camp Perry in the 60s twice. I made as much noise as everybody else did. A gal there won a police competition from all over. Cops were from all over. Her husband was a window dresser in a department store. I swear I didn't make that up. So gals are quite as good as men. If you attain a certain proficiency with it, then monthly would be enough. I really endorse the revolver because they work, they don't jam. should you get a bad round, you just pull the trigger again, another round pops up to shoot. They're easy to clean. They're nowhere near as complicated as big semi-automatics. I learned a thing, gentlemen, that'll interest you, that the vast citizenry doesn't understand the term semi-automatic. When they hear that from the Feinsteins and Obamas trying to take our guns, they think that means a machine gun. So it's an odd term, semi-automatic. Of course, you guys and a lot of the audience class knows what it is, but many people don't. Semi-automatic to them means machine gun. Anyway. Yeah, it's hard to beat a solid revolver in .38 special caliber or above.
That was going to be my next question. You know, we don't have to go crazy and do the .44 Magnum Dirty Harry thing. For the average person, I mean, you're looking at the velocity and the velocity of the bullet, of the projectile, as well as the caliber for stopping power. So okay. In a revolver, what would be your recommendation for personal protection?
As you said, it's about the weight or size of the bullet measured in weight. It's about the speed that it goes downrange. And it's about the foot-pound of impact that it has when it hits something. All those are measurable. So for defense purposes, you need to shoot human targets at a minimum twice. The first round should be at the center of mass of your lethal opponent, and the second round trained should be a headshot. Again, for any of the sensibilities of the odd class, we're talking about saving your life here or somebody else's. So a good rule of thumb is .38 special or larger. Certainly not the .44 Magnum, or because you should fire two rounds. With these horrendously huge calibers, I guarantee the second round will go up in the clouds. Also, lightweight pistols, revolvers, the same thing will happen. Recoil will take the second round up into the clouds. So I'm a standard weight instructor. So 38 special and above, if you will.
Standard weight, meaning the weight of the frame of the gun.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Don't go in. And folks, I would really, having shot in my share of revolvers as well as semi-automatics, I certainly would not go with anything less than the what are they, J frames. I don't know the.
That's a Smith and Wesson. They make J through M frame size revolvers.
Okay.
The standard, well, there's no standard. Their J frame in 38 special has called the chief special. They have one called the bodyguard. With the tip of the hammer exposed, you can fire, you can cock it for single action. But it won't catch up on clothing if you fire it through your pocket. I just recently talked five coppers as a backup gun to get the bodyguard. And one of them talked the other four to get the lightweight. So they went to our range, put the second round up in the clouds, which didn't need to be shot at all. And they all went back, five of them went back and traded it in for a standard weight Smith & Wesson bodyguard.
Okay.
So 40, you can't beat 45, really. 45
okay.
caliber.
40, well.
Special forces have just finally reverted back to that, away from the 9 mil. Finally, again.
Well, you know, again, this is a conversation that seems to be a circular argument. A 9mm versus now what the feds are going to. You said a 45. The agencies are going to, or a 40, or we're 45.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, really, what's the? Is there that big of a difference between 9mm and 45?
Yes.
Mm.
Take it back to 1909, if you will. I'm not even that old. The U.S. Army was looking for a new gun. A guy named Borchard was before Luger, was 9mm. One of the finest pointing guns in the world is the Luger. All right. Colt was there with a 45. We were at the time at war in the Philippines. The Hucks, the enemy, covered themselves in bamboo armor, and the 9mm wasn't affecting them. So that's how the M1 1911 A1 45 caliber pistol came into being, because the 45 would knock them down and penetrate bamboo armor. Moving right along, the politicians then, it's about money, decided to buy a whole bunch of 9mm. Lord knows what went on about that. They argued that it carries more rounds, it's lighter, you can carry more bullets, and like that. That's the argument for the 9mm. It jams a lot, it's too little, it's a 110-grain bullet usually, and it doesn't do the job, period. That's a matter of fact, gentlemen, that's not...
Okay. Actually, my personal favorite is a 9mm. However, you know, I
got in trouble with you last week about the keys, so I may as well...
Well... That's okay, but our local law enforcement classes here recommend the students purchase and become proficient with 9mm. So, I don't know why that would be, except, you know, they fight with or they carry what they train with. So I don't know whether they just haven't made the conversion yet or not. But, you know, anyway.
Most have 40 caliber today.
Okay.
Not 9. Some still do.
Well, okay. So of the 9mm, 40, and 45, your recommendation all around would be a 45.
Mm-hmm.
In the semi-automatic, and anything above a 38 in the revolver range. Okay. All right. Just to be clear.
38 special comes in what's called plus P. So it's 38 special. At the back of the cartridge, it says plus P. It adds velocity, hence foot-pound impact. They also make a plus P plus, which is even better. So you're up near higher. You wouldn't use those, Joe, on the range to practice with a revolver, but you'd carry them as a life-saving defense load. So, yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Okay, good. Now, as far as home defense, as long as we're talking weapons here and the home defense, for a gun in the nightstand, being a 38, the ammunition, we'll just say a 38 or whatever, you would also want to make sure you had hollow points as well, soft-tipped hollow points, so they would not go through walls necessarily. Well, it depends. New houses, they'd go through, probably go through your neighbor's house. But what ammunition do you recommend for weapons for self defense purposes? Hollow points?
I stagger them with metal penetrating. So I have 158 grain lead hollow point up, followed by a metal penetrating. But I'm on the street, and I might want to shoot at a car. You know.
Okay. Yeah.
For home, well, in the nightstand, you'd be fine with 158 grain hollow point.
Okay, yeah, that'll do the job.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, very good. What about, now, another listener question here. This comes from, well, okay, if I can believe this, Ida May from Norfolk. Thank you for your question.
Maybe.
Basement windows. Glass block windows. She's actually having her windows replaced in anticipation of things going bad. She has the traditional pull-down windows. Would you recommend, she's asking whether you would recommend glass block windows.
Rather. I sure would. Yeah, sure.
Okay. All right.
And wow. No bars.
Well, I don't think any would be necessary with glass block.
Well, they wouldn't, but I'm... People put bars in, and then they can't get out of there in a fire. So I've seen that, so it's personal with me.
How would you get out if you had glass block in the basement level of your home?
You wouldn't. You wouldn't.
So it's going to be a trade-off, ultimately. Oh. It's, yeah. All right. Okay. We will do,
and I'll have a bit of discipline. Everybody would deny that, but we'll do a whole thorough home thing, beginning to end, office thing. They're different, you know, beginning to end.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, Yoda, we've got about 5 minutes of class time left. Reinforce the high points, the necessary things that we should, at this point, be very, we're kind of far into, I believe, whatever is going to take place, I think we're far into the preparation phase. Where should we be home prep-wise, security-wise, car prep-wise, reinforce over the next couple of minutes?
I think it's utterly foolish. We're into denial repression. A lot of people deny it's not going to happen. Repress, it's certainly not going to happen to me. And if I prepare, it might somehow mystically bring on bad things. So get over that. When civil disturbances come, they come instantly, as if you perceive it's instant. It's too late to prepare 5 minutes into an emergency. So start preparing now with the basics. Basics are shelter, or add to the shelter for warmth. Basics are something to eat, and basics are water. From there on, it's light, and on, all over. In fact, I'll put one up in the Mag View. I'll share it with you guys' program, a basic list of what you need to start with. And it's like going to the dentist, I suppose. You need to make a reasonable, rational commitment. You don't have to be crazy and buy a missile silo somewhere that you won't, I promise, be able to get to anyway. So starting preparation, you can't do it quicker than today. So get a basic list and follow the list. It needn't be painful. Also, don't brag to people that you're doing this, because it is, I've lived there, been there, done that. It is protecting your family. People really misbehave that you think wouldn't when they get desperate or panicky, so don't advertise it far and wide. But please get prepared. I'd take a hard look at the survival warehouse, or the one Doug and Joe work with. I talked with them earlier today. That's me, guys. I've really enjoyed it. I've gotten a tremendous response from the seminar. I didn't know how it would work on radio, but I'm thrilled at people that are responding from all over the world, actually. and thank one and all that I'm learning for doing, so don't withhold comments, suggestions, and ideas. Please send them if you will. That's me, guys. Thank you kindly.
Very good. We
thank
are up
you.
Against we're up against the close of the program. Joe, turn it over to you.
It's been another great weekend seminar, Yoda. Look forward to next Saturday. And thanks for coming on and sharing your time and your knowledge with us and our audience.
You guys are a pleasure to work with, and I appreciate your participation more than I can say, really. Thank you kindly.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Yoda, magnifiedview.com, hard linked at homelandsecurityus.com. Thanks for tuning in. Send your questions for next week via our website, director at homelandsecurityus.com. God bless. Until next week.
Take care, everyone.